My guest today is Dr. Charlie Tiao. Charlie is a world-renowned neurosurgeon that has recently been banned from practicing neurosurgery in his home country, Australia. This decision has tested the limits of medical ethics and has brought about a fierce debate, not only from medics, but also from philosophy and law departments. In this episode, we discuss why this happened. We get Charlie's thoughts on how we could eventually defeat brain cancer and much, much more. As an aside, if you wish to check out the YouTube video, we are donating every penny that the video earns to funding vital research into treatments for brain cancer. YouTube has a simple model. The longer that the video is viewed, the more money that the video makes. So if you wished to help us to make a bigger donation, simply watch more of the video. As with any discussion that relates to ethics, there are always going to be two sides to the story. This is simply Charlie's side. Please listen, make up your own mind, and whether you are for or against or in between, that is totally okay. In fact, do leave us a comment on the YouTube video, send us an email, contact us on Instagram or TikTok. All perspectives are welcome here. All the links are below in the description. And without any further ado, I hope that you enjoyed this episode with Dr. Charlie Tiao. When I was going through your story, there's a lot in there that I really want to cover, but just kind of like a brief overview, you'd be able to tell it much better than me. So fact check me if at any point I go wrong. But I think this is some interesting context. So you were born to Chinese Singaporean parents. You started in general neurosurgery at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital before completing a fellowship in Texas. At the time, you were the only Australian neurosurgeon board certified by a US medical board. You then spent 10 years in the US as an associate professor of neurosurgery and chief of pediatric neurosurgery. When you returned back to Australia, you worked as the director of the Centre of Minimally Invasive Neurosurgery. You founded the Cure Cancer Foundation and the Charlie Tiao Foundation. You've been an invited speaker and visiting professor in more than 35 countries with associations to universities like Stanford and Johns Hopkins. You've written more than 35 book chapters, and you've sponsored education of budding neurosurgeons from developing countries like Peru and Bangladesh. And in 2011, you were appointed a member of the Order of Australia for Services to Medicine. So they had just come, some of the highlights that I noted. Man, is there anything else that perhaps you would like to point out from kind of the things that you've achieved in the field over this astonishing and long career that you've had?
Well, I'm pretty proud that I've been recognized on a global scale. I was the first Australian non-politician to address the US Congress. They asked a lot of scientists from around the world and clinicians who were interested in the brain to make a presentation to the Obama government to increase the funding for anything to do with the brain, brain mapping, brain cancer, Alzheimer's, et cetera. And there were 11 of us who presented to the US Congress, and I was included in that. I thought that was a great honor. There was another honor that I was really proud of, and that is the Reader's Digest in Australia has an award every year for the most trusted person. And I was the most trusted person for about 6 years in a row. And again, you know, when I was younger, I would have liked to have been the most eligible bachelor or something like that. But to be the most trusted person was actually a great honor as well. So, yeah, those two things I include amongst achievements that I'm very proud of.
I guess one of the reasons perhaps why I started with this is that you had a long, long list of accolades, as you said, but that you really kind of ascended to, you know, the summit of the profession. And where this seemed to come to a head was in May 2019, a professor raised concern about a large number of GoFundMe pages that were requesting considerable amount of money to have you perform surgeries on them. This then led to the NSW Medical Council conducting a special hearing into your conduct. This then led to you being prevented from, and following investigation, he was prevented from any recurring malignant intracranial tumor and brainstem tumor surgical procedures, unless you obtained written approval from an independent neurosurgeon. You were then, following on from this, investigated by the Healthcare Complaints Commission. And after a hearing in September 22, the commission found you guilty in 2023 of unsatisfactory professional conduct, for which you were reprimanded. So I guess there's quite a contrast between, as you mentioned, the highest highs to then this seemingly period of about 3 years. So I guess, what was it like to kind of go from that, presenting this research, to then needing permission to operate in your own country? What was that like for you kind of emotionally?
It wasn't as tumultuous as I would have predicted or as everyone else thought. My wise Chinese mother once told me many years ago, before she became demented, that, you know, the higher you fly, the further you fall. And it's not as if I wasn't expecting it. You know, the saying is that no one likes bad news, but everyone hates a surprise. And it was not a surprise. I mean, from the minute I returned from America to Australia, my colleagues started this campaign to vilify me and taint my reputation. It happened within 6 weeks of coming back from America, where letters of complaint were written about me from fellow neurosurgeons. And then over the years, I've had so many complaints from not only neurosurgeons but other doctors and governing bodies, you know, which were vexatious and had no sort of merit to them. And so I knew that one day they were going to strategize well enough to destroy me. And I guess I don't know. Hopefully I didn't manifest it, but I kind of expected it. And so it didn't have the emotional impact on me that you think it might have, because you're absolutely right. From the crest of a wave, I went down to the lowest of low. And you would think that I'd be depressed or angry or something. I guess, to be honest with you, I was a little bit angry about it. But no, it wasn't as bad as you think. I sort of took it in my stride. And you know, my favorite saying is that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I spent some time in India with a guru who helped me sort of understand it all. And if you want me to distill the philosophy he taught me in 3 days, it came down to one sentence, and he said, "Charlie, one day it'll all make sense." And, you know, the lesson I'd like to teach others is that, you know, if you've taken the high road, if you've been morally right, if you've done the right thing by others, if you haven't been a bad person, then, you know, these things happen, and you just have to understand that the greatest scheme is that it may happen for a good reason, and you might come out, you know, on the other side and think, oh, well, thank God that happened, you know, and thank you to all those people who destroyed that part of my life, because it's now made me enter another phase of my life, which I find just as satisfying. And that's where I'm at. That's why actually where I am at the moment.
Of course, you've stayed up very kindly till it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, your time to have this conversation. But since we've been communicating via email, man, I've lost track of the places you're telling me you're going. So could you perhaps tell people what your current situation is in terms of perhaps practicing neurosurgery now?
So with those tribunals that you mentioned, thankfully, even my greatest detractors never said I was a bad surgeon. So everyone has said, even the person who led the media campaign against me has said on record that he's a very talented, gifted surgeon. And so they haven't been able to take my license off me. I still have a full license to practice independently. What they found me guilty of was what I thought they'd always find me guilty of, and that is, you know, going outside the box and offering surgery to those who have been told they had inoperable tumors. And so, you know, the gist of what they want is they want me to toe the party line. If others have called a tumor inoperable, they want me to call it inoperable. And they use these two examples that you mentioned at the tribunal to prove their case. They were both bad outcomes. No one's disputing that. Two beautiful ladies who essentially didn't wake up from surgery. Both of them had malignant disease. Both of them were going to die very quickly. But nevertheless, I sort of hastened that death, and I made things worse with my surgery. And they said, you know, both these patients had been seen by other neurosurgeons and multidisciplinary teams, and they'd all been told that the tumor was inoperable. Then I go ahead and operate, and look what happens. See, so therefore you should not be allowed to operate on these cases. My lawyers then go, well, hang on. If you're judging his ability to make surgical decisions, surely what will influence those decisions is his past history. And therefore, we'd like to present the 11,000 cases that he's done, of which he's published in peer-reviewed journals showing excellent results, to show that his decision was not a random decision. It was actually based on a very valid history of good results. But they wouldn't let us do that. They wouldn't let us present the 11,000 cases. They wouldn't let us present any other previous cases that went well. They wouldn't let us present any testimonials from patients or fellow neurosurgeons, because their argument was that we're here to discuss the two cases on the table and nothing else. It was terrible, Joe. It was a total witch hunt right from the start. It's built on a system where the plaintiff, or the accuser, the plaintiff, the judge, the jury, and the executioner, all the one person. I mean, they're all these fellow neurosurgeons who don't like me. They've made it very clear they don't like me. They've tried to destroy me for many, many years, and they're the ones who made the complaints. They're the ones who then field the complaints and listen to the complaints, and they're the ones that then judge, and they're the ones that then execute. It's like, hang on, there's something a little bit wrong about that, that I should be, you know, the case from Perth, for example, the complaint was made by a doctor to the West Australian Medical Board. Well, the person on the West Australian Medical Board who fields the complaints was a doctor who made the complaint. He complained to himself about me. And, you know, he wrote a letter to himself saying, don't you think this case should be pursued? And then, of course, he goes, yes, of course it should be pursued. And it's just like, it never smelt right. It was always a done deal. The public know it. The public have been amazingly supportive. Patients of mine have been amazingly supportive. And really, it just has never passed the pub test. It's based on malice, jealousy, vindictiveness. It's just all so wrong. So anyway, look, the bottom line is that I could go on and on and on, and as I go on and on, Joe, I'd get angrier and angrier. But I've tried to, again, be a little bit more philosophical about it, and you know, I'm really enjoying teaching now because I still have a full license. So that means I can practice overseas. So what I do is if I see an Australian patient who needs surgery, no one else is prepared to do it, they're prepared to go overseas, and I usually operate in countries that allow me to operate. Now, there are some countries where the medical council watch the 60 Minutes episode and basically cancelled me. You know, the whole cancel culture. Once you have a bad mark against your name on social media, it kind of sticks. Whether it's right or wrong, whether you're found guilty or innocent, it sticks. And so, you know, I offered to do some charity work in Papua New Guinea where they had some really difficult cases lined up for me to operate on. And the Papua New Guinea fraternity or governing bodies watched the 60 Minutes and stopped me from doing charity work in Papua New Guinea. I mean, Joe, it's just it's crazy. It's crazy.
I think that there's probably two things that people listening to your story will like when I was looking at it from the outside, trying to kind of balance. The first one is because, as we mentioned, you had had a significant amount of accolades. With success can come people that are jealous, people that are envious, people that may feel that they want that for themselves. And if I tear this person down, that creates more space for me to achieve that. A vicious, nasty way to try to get to the top. But imagine there's also people there that say, you know, the argument that perhaps there's no smoke without fire, that if there are a number of complaints, then maybe there's something there. So how do we kind of balance those two between the series of complaints versus obviously you'd had a lot of success and there's a lot of jealous people out there or could be out there. How do we kind of connect those two?
I think there's always two sides to the story, Joe, and I've got to take some blame for the malevolence against me. I mean, I'm no angel for a starter. I'm a bit of a show off. I've never approached media, but whenever media approaches me, it's not as if I say no. I like the attention. I'm not backward in coming forward. So I almost dug my own grave. Well, that's the first thing. The second thing is I lack diplomacy. I'm not good at playing the game. And, you know, if I played the game a bit better, it was a little bit more pleasant at meetings and didn't tell people they were idiots and, you know, sort of said the right things, maybe I wouldn't have alienated as many colleagues. The third thing is that I'm going to bring this up, but I'm not bringing it up as a confession, but I've been told by many people who don't like me that I'm narcissistic, I've got the God complex. And it does make you think that, you know, hang on, did I do that case that went badly because I was trying to prove something to myself or I was trying to give myself a good reputation or I was giving myself a challenge, or did I do it in the patient's best interests? And I actually think it's good to have that internal debate all the time, or else you do become very full of your own sort of importance and your own worth and your own abilities and skills. It's good to question that. And so I actually haven't minded the criticism because it does make me think, you know, please, Charlie, make sure you're making this decision to do surgery not based on ego, not based on some sort of power mongering, not based on money or reputation, purely based on that's exactly what you would do if that was your loved one and you're doing it in their best interests. Again, one of the criticism is that I've achieved this sort of status in the public of being a godlike figure who can save people that no one else can save, who's this great surgeon. And so when people come and see me, it's almost like they put their life in my hands because it's like they have, you know, absolute trust in me. And, you know, have I abused that trust? And again, I have to ask myself that question. Maybe I have in a few cases. I'll be the first to say, look, you know, it's not difficult to do that. When someone comes with a terrible tumor, they know it's bad, you know it's bad, but they go, Charlie, I trust you implicitly, I want you to do it. Well, it's very difficult to know, are they saying that because they really want to give it one last shot, or are they saying that because, you know, they do think I'm some sort of godlike figure who can save them when no one else can? And I'll never be able to answer the question correctly or, on, you know, as to which I am, but I have to admit that has to be one of the potential flaws in me, that I've achieved this status, I may be trying to prove something, and I've created my own sort of level of animosity amongst colleagues because I'm just not the sort of person who, you know, engenders the touchy-feely sort of feelings from my colleagues. I'm just not like that. You know, someone tried to show me diplomacy. It was really funny. The CEO of the Children's Hospital was a lovely guy, and he said, Charlie, you know, you're a great surgeon. We want to keep you, but you're pissing everyone off. Why don't I come and teach you how to be a bit more diplomatic? And he sat in a meeting, and, you know, this lady at the front who was conducting the meeting goes, you know, here's a craniopharyngioma. It's clearly inoperable. Next case. And I put my head up and go, no, it's not. It's not inoperable. I think I could take that out. And she got a back up and she didn't even respond. And she said, next case. She didn't even discuss it. Anyway, Les said to me after the meeting, he goes, Charlie, you know, that was very confrontational. What you should have said is, yes, Heather, you're right. That is probably inoperable. But, you know, what do you think about this? And, you know, and just sort of play the game and be a little bit more diplomatic. You know, I couldn't do it, Joe. It's just not me. I'd be dishonest to myself. And so, you know, that is a flaw of mine, and I'm willing to take it on the chin that, you know, if I'd been a little bit more diplomatic, if I'd been a little bit more sort of showed a bit more humility or, you know, false humility or humility, whatever you want to call it, then maybe I would have been more accepted by my colleagues.
When you think about that kind of power that, you know, you have, someone comes to you with a deadly brain tumor that, yeah, you know, other people are not perhaps willing to operate on, but you think, you believe that there is a chance that you could save that person's life. Nobody else can, but you have that, or nobody else is willing to try, but you have the ability. That must come with some psychological kind of, there must be some sort of interest in psychology going on, but there, you know, it, as you mentioned, that kind of comparison to a god, in that sense where you can play life or death, what is that like to carry that kind of power, like to go around with that kind of thing that you can prolong someone's life? You can.
Oh, I can answer that very easily. Mm. The first thing is that I've got a sign on my wall, and it's a quote from one of my mentors, and it says, in neurosurgery, you're never on top of the world for more than 10 minutes. And so what that means essentially is that, you know, you do this fantastic case, you're patting yourself on the back, you're puffing your chest out, you think of God's gift to neurosurgeons, and then 10 minutes later you hear from the ICU nurse that the patient's crashed and become hypotensive, had a big bleed, and and you know, and unfortunately in neurosurgery that happens. It's life and death. It's unforgiving. It is emotionally and physically incredibly taxing, and it's incredibly challenging. And it's very hard to puff your chest out continuously and think you're God's gift, because you know you get brought down to a very, very base level almost every 10 minutes. So that's one thing. The other thing is to surround yourself with people who aren't sycophants. And so all the fellows who I train, I have a fellowship program where neurosurgeons from around the world can come and train and learn my techniques. And I make sure that they're the sort of people who I would like to be my neurosurgeon. They've got a mind of their own. They're happy to speak their mind. They're not wilting flowers. And I like surrounding myself with people like that. I mean, it's hard sometimes because they challenge you and they call you an idiot and they say things like, well, I wouldn't have done that case. But that is good feedback to get. And so I've tried to build up an environment whereby I don't get that God complex, and I'm always sort of self-auditing. And, nice. You know, and self-auditing is important as well. You know, you've got to review your cases, you've got to publish, and you've got to get other people to assess the outcomes so that you don't fudge the results. And so if you look at my CV, I've got over 170 peer-reviewed articles now, and a lot of them are on complications. I'm known within the neurosurgical world of being very honest about my complications. So there's a paper about complications in skull-based surgery in children, complications of endoscopic third ventriculostomy, complications of posterior fossa surgery, complications of endonasal surgery. So, you know, I'm very aware that it's important to not only boast about your good outcomes, but also to be willing to talk about your bad outcomes.
And in terms of, you mentioned earlier that you've done 11,000 surgeries. And in preparation for this, I should add that I read many a comment from people, tributes from other professors, other neurosurgeons that attested. Many people said things like, you know, without you, my family would not be alive. I would not be alive. So in terms of like a batting average across, you know, to use that term, how across the span of your career in a very, very difficult field, how does your kind of, I guess, success rate, whatever that means in when you're dealing with very complex brain cancer, compare to, for instance, other surgeons? Is that quantifiable?
It is, and I've actually published. So if you look, for example, at brainstem gliomas. That's one of the very controversial areas. For your audience, the brainstem is an area of the brain that's about the size of your thumb, through which 100 billion neurons travel from the brain to the spinal cord to the body.
Wow.
And it has its own nuclei as well, and its own centers of importance, like the center for breathing, for example, is in the brainstem. So you can imagine that any tumor within the brainstem is considered pretty tiger country, and a lot of people just will not operate on the brainstem. In fact, 99.999% of neurosurgeons don't touch it. It's a no-go zone. Okay, so if you look at our paper, which is the largest series of surgery for brainstem intrinsic tumors called gliomas, the poor outcome rate was 6%. So that means that 6% of patients, the surgery was terrible. It either made them worse or didn't prolong their life at all, or both. And, you know, I'm not proud of that figure. And they're terrible outcomes. But in terms of the world literature, it's very, very acceptable. And what I mean by that is that a lot of people who publish their series of brain tumors elsewhere in the brain that isn't as eloquent and isn't as risky have a complication rate or a poor outcome rate of about 5 to 6%. So in other words, my surgery on the most risk, the riskiest, most difficult surgeries in neurosurgery is comparable to the results of other tumors in other parts of the brain. In terms of mortality, for example, the surgeon who was judging me at the tribunal, honestly, under oath, said that his mortality rate, in other words, the number of people he killed for a standard craniotomy was 2 to 3%. So 2 to 3 people out of 100 cases that he did died on the table from his surgery. So if you look at my mortality rate, it's 12 cases out of 11,000 operations. And so my mortality rate is significantly lower than his, and yet my cases are the world's most difficult cases. And the worst thing about the tribunal was that one of the criticisms was that I wasn't honest to the patients with my consent, and I didn't tell them how dangerous the operation really was. And the reason they said that is because they got these expert witnesses to say that if I had done a tumor like that, I would have told the patient that the chance of death was 70%. Tio told the patient that the risk of death was 5%. Therefore, he severely underestimated the risk of the operation. Well, that's where I said, well, hang on, my risk of death is 5%. Right. I mean, so I was very honest with my figures, but they said, no, you meant to tell them, you know, I was being judged by the figures and the results of a standard neurosurgeon who probably has never even done a brainstem glioma or brainstem tumor. So, no, I'm very happy with my results. I mean, I'd like to get them all perfect so that there's no bad outcomes, but and that's what I'm still practicing neurosurgery. Every time I do a case, I think, you know, I want this case to be the perfect case, no complications, no bad outcomes, complete resection of the tumor, prolongation of life or survival. And, you know, that's what I yearn for with every case still, even though my results compared to the literature are very, very good.
And it's fair to say that many of these people, when they come to you, that without perhaps taking the risk, that their lifespan is not going to be a long one without, but the potential upside that you could do something. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Again, the two cases brought up by the tribunal, one was going to die probably within a week, and the other one probably wouldn't have died for about 3 months. But they both had malignant tumors that were called inoperable, untreatable by other neurosurgeons. The lady from Melbourne had already had radiation and chemotherapy and failed that. And so she wanted one last chance to live a bit longer. And hence agreed to go ahead with surgery. And the other thing they said was that, you know, I didn't tell them how risky the surgery was. Well, come on, Joe. These people had been seen by neurosurgeons in their states. Their neurosurgeons had told them that the tumor was so difficult, so risky that they weren't prepared to do it. You can't tell me that they came to Sydney not knowing that the operation was a risky operation. I mean, really, did I have to spell it out to them, and did I have to try and dampen their hopes. You know, I felt for both those cases, as I do with many cases, that they know the figures. They know how bad things are. They're looking straight down the barrel. They're facing death. And they've come to me because they're not prepared to die yet. Not because I'm saying to them, you know, there's a 100% chance it's going to be successful. They're not prepared to die yet, and they're willing to give it one last shot so they've got peace of mind that they did everything they could before they gave up the fight.
One of the things that I thought about when I was kind of thinking about this conversation, I was reading a story a while back about the ancient Greek physician Hippocrates. And, you know, this guy was known really as, you know, the outstanding face of medicine. Doctors, they take the Hippocratic Oath. And two quotes from Hippocrates that stood out that your story really illuminates. So Hippocrates, two quotes from him. As to diseases, make a habit of two things, to help or at least to do no harm. But he also said, extreme remedies are very appropriate for extreme diseases, which I guess many people would say in the case of, for instance, brain cancers, that certainly could perhaps constitute that. So, for instance, you've pointed by there to some of your peers, other neurosurgeons that say, you know what, like this person is deadly, let's do no further harm, palliative care, comfort for the rest of their days, versus perhaps more of an aggressive approach, let's take perhaps an extreme remedy to try to remedy an extreme situation. How perhaps should those two things be balanced in the case of your situation between the do no harm versus the try to remedy an unthinkable situation? Is there kind of any way to think about those two things combined?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about honest consent. And again, that's where I think I failed, because I thought I gave honest consent, but I never recorded the consent process. And I knew, like all doctors know, that patients often only hear what they want to hear. And they take in about a third of everything you say. So really, to protect myself, I should have recorded my consultations every time. Now, I do that now. I've learnt my lesson. But between you and me and God himself, I promise you, Joe, I consent the patients very, very well. I spend a lot of time talking to them. I make sure I put it in language that they can understand. I make sure there's someone else in the room to hear it. I allow them to record it if they want to, knowing that they may not remember it all. And all my fellows who come and train with me, you know, some of them have said, listen, Charlie, I learned a little bit of neurosurgery, but the thing I learned most was the way you talk to your patients and consent your patients. And again, without boasting, because I don't want to boast, but until all the negative media, Joe, I'd never been sued. You know, and I'm the first to tell you I've had some bad outcomes. And probably more bad outcomes than, you know, the average Joe Blow, because I deal with these difficult tumors. And yet my patients have been very happy with the outcomes, even if they're bad, because I've been very honest with them up front. I always say to people, look, I can't make any promises except I'm going to try my hardest for you. I'm going to treat your loved one. I'm going to treat you like you were a member of my own family. That's the only promise I can make. And I always... And when I teach my residents and fellows how to consent, I always talk about this concept of glooming. I go, you've got to gloom them. If anything, you should exaggerate the complications so they, you know, they really do understand. So even if there's a 0.11001% chance of death, you talk about death. You always say, listen, it may be a simple operation, but there's always a risk of death. There's always a risk of paralysis. And if you think the risk of paralysis is 5%, double it. So that they understand. I'm known for that. Yeah, that's how you do it. It's honest consent. Now, here's the problem. The problem is that there are surgeons out there who don't give honest consent. And, we all know that. I mean, public know that. Doctors know that. There are doctors out there who have a lot of other agendas. Their agenda is not the patient's best interest. Their agenda is to save their own butt, to not piss off their colleagues, to be popular, to make money, to build reputation, to build power. There are unfortunately all these other things that go into some surgeons' decision-making tree, things that are not honourable and not in the patient's best interests. And, for example, if I didn't want to be in the situation I'm in now, I could have easily said to the last 1,000 patients, I can't do that case, I'm sorry, knowing full well that I could, but at least it would have saved my butt. At least it wouldn't have put me in the situation I'm in now. And I can tell you now, Joe, with hand on heart, as God is my witness, since this has happened to me in the last 3 years, I see all these cases of patients who have been whose tumours have been biopsied or called inoperable by surgeons who I know have the talent to take these tumours out, but they've chosen not to because they've seen what's happened to me and they know that they can't put themselves out on a limb. If someone else is called inoperable, even if he's the world's worst surgeon, if they've called inoperable, you've got to call it inoperable or else you're going to be hanging yourself out and putting your head on the your neck on the line. So, it's sent a very, very clear and terrible message to other surgeons. If you don't toe the party line, if you try and give contrary second opinions, we're going to get you because we got Charlie Teo, we'll get you as well. It's been terrible. It's been absolutely terrible. There's a 22-year-old girl in Brisbane right now with a benign operable tumour of the brainstem that I can remove. I've done plenty of them before. She was told the tumour was inoperable by a very competent surgeon who could have easily at least just biopsied it, but now she's been sent for radiotherapy. The tumour is radio insensitive. She's going to die in the next 12 to 18 months, and she could have been saved with an operation. And that's what's happened since this witch hunt on me.
How many patients have you ever told that you wouldn't operate on them?
Not as many as I've told that I would, but probably my consultation day was a Tuesday. I'd see 20 patients with brain tumours, of which I would tell probably two every week that no more than that, probably two or three or four every week that their surgeon was right, that I think this tumour is truly inoperable. I'm sorry if I've wasted your time and I'm really sorry that I can't do anything, but it is truly inoperable. Now, some of those patients haven't liked that opinion and they sort of force the issue, like we really want surgery. We know that you're saying. We know that you're not recommending surgery. We want you to do it. And occasionally I've capitulated or have sent them to someone else who I think might give them an operation. Once I capitulated and I did a TEDx talk on this one patient and it turned out that the mother was right. I didn't want to operate. I thought it was malignant. I thought the risk was too high. As a little girl with a brainstem tumour, she forced the issue. She said, look, she's dying. She's just been put on a ventilator. We know she's dying. We've been seen by so many different neurosurgeons around the world. This is our last chance. We want you to do it. I didn't want to do it, Joe. But I did it, and it turned out to be benign. I got it out, and she's fine. She's alive and well today. But that's rare. In most cases, when I say it's inoperable, they accept that decision.
One of the things from doing this podcast is I've always become interested in consequential environments. So environments where the most dire consequences could take place. And obviously neurosurgery, that clearly comes under that rubric. And I had a chat with a Harvard professor, Anupam Jenner. And he wrote a book called Random Acts of Medicine, and he described to me how that much of life or death can come down to randomness. You get a cardiac arrest, but unfortunately there's a marathon in your city on the day that can contribute to death. But one of the things he told me was that one thing that they found a significant effect of was adverse effects on a surgeon's birthday. So literally, if it was a surgeon's birthday, then that was significantly correlated with worse effect for patient outcomes. And one of the things that I'm interested about is, I wonder if you could just kind of paint the picture. You're operating on someone. How small are the margins? Like, if you have an argument with your spouse, or if you have a bad night's sleep, can these things like really contribute to like adverse outcomes? Because I'm just trying to like quantify the level of skill and precision, minor details involved in whether something's a success or whether something's not.
Oh, I can answer that very clearly. There are courses to help mitigate risk and complications, and they often cite airline pilots and how airline pilots avoid catastrophes. And they bring up this whole concept of chain of errors. And chain of errors means exactly what you said. If you wake up on the wrong side of the bed and you're grumpy right from the get-go, then of course you're going to be grumpy with your wife. You're going to have an argument. You're going to go to work. You're going to get road rage on the way to work. When you get to work, you're going to be short with a nurse, or within short be with you, be short with you. You'll then start the case in a bad mood with a little bit of a tremor because of the adrenaline that's been pumping and your anger. You'll then drop an instrument, and that instrument will be essential. You'll then say, bugger, I'll just take another instrument. And that instrument will be the wrong instrument, and then you'll have disaster. And it's this whole chain of errors that you've got to try and stop. Neurosurgery is so unforgiving, Joe. It is so, so unforgiving that all it takes is one minor error for you to rush a little bit, for you to be distracted by someone, for you to be in a bad mood and develop a little bit of a tremor. And that can mean the difference between life and death, or sight and no sight, an arm that works or an arm that doesn't work. So I have a routine. Firstly, I keep very fit because I think it's incumbent on the surgeon to give his best. And giving your best in a 16-hour operation is making sure you've got good core strength and you've got the stamina to withstand a 16-hour operation. The second thing is I make sure that I cancel surgery if any of those chain of errors start. So if I wake up in a bad mood, if I'm feeling sick, if I've had an argument with the wife, I will absolutely cancel a difficult case. The next thing is I won't talk to the family before the operation. I think that should be done before the day of the operation, in your rooms, in a controlled environment where they can feel not rushed and they can have all their questions answered. So if a family still has questions on the day of surgery, and my staff will attest to this, I will cancel surgery. If they still have questions, it means that my consent process wasn't good enough. And so I cancel the operation and I bring them back to the office the following week, sit them down. Okay, now ask the questions, get it straight in your head, and we'll do the case the following week. I've had a lot of patients and parents be upset with me for that, but I'm very proud of having that that criteria. The next thing is I get in the zone. And I think long, tedious brain surgery is not dissimilar to a long tennis match or a long sort of game where you have to be very, very focused and keep your eye on the prize. So, again, my staff know that they can't interrupt me. I sit in the corner. I look at the x-rays. I then review some videos of previous operations that are similar so I can get an idea of the sort of things I'm going to be looking for that might get in the way. I sort of plan the operation in 3D in my own mind, and I get in the zone. And like a sportsman would get in the zone. I think all those things are essential to a good outcome. Okay, the next one is, and having now operated in many different countries without my team, without all my instruments, you know, I think part of the reason why I've had exceptional results and I can do tumors that no one else can do is not me, it's my team. I have the world's best anesthetist, who I don't have to check on. He's on the ball. Well, I've got two and they're both on the ball. They're both brilliant anesthetists. They're both calm under pressure. I have a nurse who often gives me the instrument that I need, not the instrument I've asked for. If I ever get short during an operation and say, why did you do that? Or don't give me that. And it's, oh, I'm in the wrong. and they're in the right, they won't argue because they know that arguing at that time is the wrong time, wrong place, and they'll just, you know, accept it, take it on the chin, even though they might have been in the right and I might have been in the wrong. I can tell ribald jokes without worrying about being PC. It is my domain. It is my fiefdom, and I can concentrate fully on the patient and not have to worry about all these superfluous influences like, you know, being politically correct or saying please and thank you every time I ask for an instrument. That's how good my team is. We work as, a very close-knit unit. Again, I think it's essential because I can remember doing a case in another hospital at one stage and the nurse bumped me and the sucker went straight into the brainstem. And, it's she didn't do it maliciously or anything. It was just a pure accident. But, you know, neurosurgery is that vital that a small bump on the hand can cause death or paralysis. And so you have to be on your game. The people around you have to be on your game. You can't have a chain of errors. You can't have a bad day. It's because, you know, you've got to treat your patient like they were a member of your own family. Mm-hmm. And would you want your surgeon to come in a bad mood and be operating on your brain when he's in a bad mood or when he's, got gastro or, or when his nurse is incompetent or she's arguing with him? You don't want that. You know, I wouldn't want that with my loved one. So if I wouldn't want it with my loved one, why would I then subject my patients to that? You're absolutely right. It is tiger country. It's unforgiving. And you have to make sure that everything is going your way.
And I suppose people listening to that, they go, wow, like that requires so much concentration, attention to detail, so many factors. And given your rise that we discussed earlier, the accolades, the achievements, and now the kind of flip side, the other side of the coin, professional criticism, these tribunals, many people might be wondering, you know, why doesn't Dr. Tiao sail off into the sunset? Why doesn't he go and call it a day and enjoy the rest of it? What is it that, you know, motivates you to kind of keep going?
Oh, well, funny you should bring that up because I have that internal argument with myself on a daily basis. In fact, it was a French neurosurgeon who quoted an English paper. So let me tell you the paper. So I held a meeting and, again, in the spirit of, you know, being honest, with your results, the theme of the meeting was complications. So it was the International Society of Pediatric Neurosurgeons meeting for which I was the chairman in Sydney many years ago. And I asked one of the surgeons to talk about a subject, play with fire and you'll get burnt. And it's really funny, Joe. He's a great man. He unfortunately died recently. And he said, can I change the topic, Charlie? I said, yeah, fine. So he talked about when you play with fire, you'll get burnt out. And instead, he presented a paper on surgical burnout. And it goes like this. A paper published in the British Medical Journal looked at the longevity of surgeons, not just neurosurgeons, but all surgeons, with the variable or the difference being there were two groups, one that retired at 60 and another group that retired at 65. Okay. Those surgeons who retired at 60 lived an average of 19 years after retirement. Those surgeons who retired at 65 lived an average of 4 years after retirement. There were no other confounders. There was equipoise between the two groups. So they had to come up with some sort of rationale as to why there was this statistically incredibly significant disparity between retirement age and longevity. And they came up with the fact that, you know, as you get older, you don't realize that the stress that you've been under all your life, which your body has been able to accept because you've got very elastic blood vessels and, you know, you're young, the older body can't take that stress. So you don't realize it, but you're still doing stressful things sure, it's your everyday bread and butter, but it's still stressful and your body can no longer handle it. And so if you operate till 65, you're going to pay a price for that. So with that in mind and that study in mind, I always wanted to retire at 60. And yet I kept operating after 60 because I was doing cases that no one else would do. And, you know, if I had some junior person to whom I could have referred those patients, I promise you, Joe, I would have retired. I had lots of other things to do. I had enjoyed a great career. My ex-wife wanted me to spend more time with her, and I didn't, and that's why she's an ex-wife. And so, yeah, I could have retired at 60, but I just looked around and goes, you know, that's that little girl, I can save her. And no one else prepared to do it. And so I just thought, well, if I can still do it and still keep getting good results, then I'll just keep going until hopefully someone taps me on the shoulder before I start getting bad results and say, Charlie, maybe it's time to retire. But believe me, Joe, every day I'm thinking, you know, I did a difficult case in Peru the other day and it was 4 hours into it and it was really difficult. And I thought, what am I doing this for? I'm in my 60s. You know, I wouldn't expect a 40-year-old surgeon to do this case. But the patient did well. The surgeons who were watching appreciated the learning experience and the techniques that I was using. And so I just felt like, you know, I still have something to offer the people. I still have something to offer the discipline of neurosurgery. And I'm still enjoying it.
Is there something specific to brain cancers, just in terms of the nature of how undignifying it can be, how much it can rob people of so much of their lives? Is there something specific about that? Like if you were, I don't know, a cardiac surgeon, you know, or a urologist or something like this, is there something about the field that you're in and the work that you're doing? Is there something about that that kind of drives you on perhaps?
Yeah, it's all about challenging, you know, challenges. And I like a challenge. I mean, every year I give myself a physical challenge, like doing a marathon or climbing a mountain or something like that. And so I still consider neurosurgery a huge challenge. I'm not at the stage where I've rested on my laurels and think, you know, I've conquered neurosurgery. I've beaten it. It still beats me on a daily basis where, you know, I get a phone call saying that some little girl has died from recurrence of a brain tumor. And I think to myself, well, gee, you know, that was useless. I took the tumor out, I bought her 2 years of life, but boy, she still died. There's got to be something else I can do. In terms of brain cancer, yeah, I'm glad you've brought it up because if anything comes out of this conversation, I want to raise awareness about brain cancer. So here's the fact about brain cancer, Joe. It is the world's deadliest cancer, firstly. No one disputes that. It kills more children in the developing world than any other cancer and, indeed, any other disease. So in the UK, in America, in Australia, brain cancer is the number one killing disease of all children. It kills more young adults than any other cancer, more women under the age of 39, more men under the age of 44 than any other cancer. And it is the least funded of all the cancers. Now, I don't know how that works because it's killing our children. You would think that it'd get the most funding, but it doesn't. It gets the least funding. In your country, in the United States, in Australia, it gets the least funding of all the cancers. People adopt a very nihilistic opinion about it. It's like, oh, my God, they're going to die anyway. So, really, there's nothing much we can offer. So, therefore, oncologists often don't specialize in it because poor old oncologists don't have any chemotherapeutic regimens to give patients. And scientists, again, adopt a very nihilistic approach to it. So it's a self-perpetuating problem where, you know, because it's so deadly, not many people specialize in it, and that's why people continue to die and you get this very negative cycle. I would like people to know that there is a template that we can quote. And the template is leukemia. So when I was a medical student, leukemia killed more children than something like an 85% mortality rate from leukemia. Now, as you know, it's flipped. It's the other way around. It's an 85% cure rate for leukemia. And what's done that? Research. Money, research, awareness. So awareness raises funds, funds fund scientists, scientists find cures. It's very, very simple template. And so if we could raise awareness about brain cancer, and that is it kills our children, our next generation, our future, then I'm hoping that more funding will go into it. And with that more funding, more interests, more scientific research, more people specializing in it, and eventually we can flip the survival figures like we have with leukemia.
And in terms of some cancers, as you just mentioned, to give a good example, leukemia, a lot of progress has been made. Various other cancers, a lot of progress has been made in, curing, preventing, dealing with. If you were to take the last 50 years of progress in, brain cancers, how much progress has been made?
So most people say nothing. So most people say the mortality rates and survival figures are not dissimilar to 50 years ago.
Wow.
But again, to be a little bit more optimistic, they have improved a little bit. So we used to quote 50 weeks as the average survival with a malignant brain cancer, the most common type. It's called a GBM, glioblastoma multiforme. It's the most common type of brain tumor. Unfortunately, it's malignant. It's 100% deadly, and most people are dead within a very short period of time. That 50 weeks is now extended to about 14 months. So it's not good, Joe. So it's gone from 10 months to 14 months, but we have made a little bit of progress, and I'm pleased to say that I believe we're going to be on the steep curve of progress pretty soon. Now that we've mapped the human genome and there's so much being done in genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, transcriptomics, I really do believe, and with supercomputers, crunching data, machine learning, AI, it's all going to contribute to an accelerated process, hopefully, of finding treatments and cures and a cure for brain cancer. We're not quite yet there, but I think we're on the cusp of something pretty good. So I'm quite optimistic that in my lifetime we're going to find, if not a cure for brain cancer, much more effective treatments than we have currently.
I wonder if you could perhaps just talk about, in comparison to other types of cancers, one like prostate cancer, much more simple type of treatable cancer. Why is brain cancer, I wonder if you could perhaps talk about, why is this so complex? Why has, as you just mentioned, that across 50 years, we've only been able to extend the lifespan 4 months? What is there about the kind of the mechanisms of it that make it so difficult?
I could talk for a week on that. So let me give you an analogy. If cancers had an IQ, then, breast cancer would have an IQ of 100. Prostate cancer would have an IQ of 80. skin cancer would have an IQ of 50. Leukemia has got an IQ of about 110, and brain cancer has an IQ that's greater than 160.
Science of the cancers.
It's incredibly smart cancer. If I was the Lord Almighty Maker, I would not have been able to design such a brilliant cancer. They say that brain cancer is so heterogeneous. In other words, there's so many different cell types and antigens and proteins on walls, et cetera, that it's almost like dealing with 30 different cancers all in one. And so I'm sure you've heard about immunotherapy. Immunotherapy is where you identify a foreign protein or something on the wall of the cancer or inside the cancer cell, and then you target that protein or abnormal element using an antibody. And so antibodies kill the cancer cells because you've identified this foreign protein. Well, that's great when that foreign protein is present on the majority or all of the cancer cells. Something like melanoma, for example, it's a very homogeneous cancer, so immunotherapy has worked brilliantly for melanoma. But brain cancer is very heterogeneous. There's many different types, and there's not many proteins that are shared by all the cancer cells. Okay, that's one problem. The next problem is that whoever made our bodies designed them beautifully so that the brain was protected from toxins. It's called the blood-brain barrier, and it stops toxins from getting into the brain. Being such a vital organ, it's essential to its survival. Well, the worst thing about that is that it also stops chemotherapy agents, because they're toxins, from getting into the tumors. So the blood-brain barrier that's meant to save the host, in fact, contributes to killing the host when it comes to brain cancer. Okay, the next thing is that it's intelligent enough to talk to itself. So there are very eloquent studies showing cross-talking between cancer cells. So if you present one side of the cancer with a chemotherapeutic agent, for example, it teaches the other cells on the other side to resist that chemotherapy, to build up resistance. Okay, sometimes you can starve cancers of oxygen and they die. Well, it turns out that brain cancer loves being starved of oxygen and grows faster. Okay, it's got another gene in it that makes it grow faster when you take it out. So when you take out a brain tumor and you don't take it all out, the remaining bit goes, fantastic, I've got room to breathe now, and it grows faster.
Wow.
Okay, it's got the MDR gene, the multi-drug resistant gene, which again helps it develop resistance to all drugs. Okay, it also likes more oxygen. So some cancers don't like oxygen, but brain cancer thrives on a lack of oxygen and oxygen itself. Okay, there are some cancers you've got a fantastic doctor over there who is on TV a lot, and he does a lot of documentaries. What's his name? Michael Mosley.
Michael Mosley, yeah. Does a lot of stuff with nutrition and...
Okay, so he talks about the 5-2 diet. And the 5-2 diet is essentially starving yourself so your body goes into ketosis. And ketosis is when you haven't taken in glucose, so your body says, oh, gee, I need to provide some sort of metabolites for my cells, and it starts producing ketone bodies. Cancer cells traditionally don't like ketone bodies, and they like glucose. And in fact, they don't survive in a ketotic environment. What? Well, brain cancer loves it. So brain cancer can live not only on glucose, but it can also live on ketone bodies. It's the only cancer that thrives on ketone bodies. Look, Joe, I could just keep going.
Yeah.
It is a brilliant cancer. A lot of cancers, when they grow really quickly, they outstrip themselves of blood supply. And so they starve themselves of blood and they become necrotic. Well, brain cancer has a gene in it called VEGF gene, which helps build a lattice work of blood vessels called neovascularity, so that there's always a rich blood supply to the cancer cells. And, you know, again, I just keep going and going. It's a brilliant cancer that is incredibly intelligent and has, unfortunately, to this day, evaded, the best minds in science.
And this was actually one of the interesting things that people were actually quite interested in me asking. And there was something related to, you know, there's an old joke that, you know, whatever you treat, that eventually you will kill you as a doctor. And obviously, and I pray, obviously, that this doesn't happen to you, of course. But out of curiosity, you know, many people are interested in this. You know, what would your attitude be should you ever develop one of these horrific things? Because, of course, you can't operate on yourself. You know, I wonder if those kind of thoughts have ever gone through your mind, and what would you do about that? How would you react, type of thing?
Yeah, they go through my mind all the time, and foolishly, I used to consent and judge patients based on my own criteria of quality of life. So my quality of life, like everyone's, is so personal and so different that I can tell you what I would do, but please don't think that I'm saying that's what other people should do. And again, one of the greatest mistakes a doctor can make is to judge others on their own sort of criteria. And again, if I could give you an example of that, where a lady came into me with an ependymoma of a craniocervical junction, the junction between a brain and a spinal cord, and she'd been told by neurosurgeons at another hospital in Sydney that it was inoperable 8 years previously. And so she accepted that decision and went away and slowly became quadriplegic. So when she saw me, she heard about me in the media. She came and saw me and said, listen, I'm quadriplegic now. I listened to the other neurosurgeons. They told me it was inoperable. But now I don't want to die and I want you to take it out. Well, there she was in a wheelchair, not able to move her arms or her legs, and the only thing she could do was breathe and speak. And so me, being a young, cocky doctor, go, look, I can take that tumor out, but really, do you want me to? I mean, I said to her, you can't even scratch your nose. What sort of quality of life do you have? Oh, my God, Joe. She tore me to shreds. She goes, how dare you tell me what quality of life is for me? She goes, I don't need to be able to walk along the beach. I don't need to be able to scratch my nose. I have 16-year-old twin daughters. And quality of life to me is imparting my wisdom to my daughters at a time when they need it. Wow. In other words, the ability to speak was her quality of life. And there was I thinking she should not have had surgery because she couldn't scratch her nose. Oh, my God. She made me realize from that moment on that I should never, ever judge someone else's wish to live based on my own wish to live. So that's a long answer to your question. And your question was, you know, how would I deal with it? Well, I would like to think I'd have the courage of my patients, and I'd like to, because they're incredibly courageous. They read Google and they know that this is a terrible cancer. They hear me speak. They know that the odds are stacked against them, but they still have this amazing capacity to be hopeful and to maintain hope and to think they're going to be the exception to the rule. I love it. It inspires me. Their courage inspires me. I would like to think I'd have that courage, but I'm scared that I would be quite cowardly and I wouldn't take on the fight, and I'd know that the odds were stacked against me and it's all too hard and I'd just give up and not fight it. Look, I don't know. You should never judge others unless you're in that situation. So I don't know what I'd do unless I was actually in the situation, looking down the barrel of death. I'd like to think I'd be courageous, but I'm scared that I would probably just go, oh, shit. I'd have to have surgery, radiotherapy, chemotherapy. It's going to change my quality of life. I won't be able to do this. I've got the risk of that. And maybe not have the courage to fight it.
Man, beautifully said. And I think this has really certainly given me a lot to think about. And hopefully, you know, that this has given, you know, our listeners and, you know, the people that come to watch this kind of a greater insight into this very complex story that, you know, you found yourself in, the, you know, inhumane and constant challenge about dealing with brain cancers. And as I mentioned, the start, and there's, you know, all the avenue, all the revenue from this that this podcast makes, we're donating to fighting and to donate into research into brain cancer. So, man, this has been such a pleasure. But before I let you go, there's a couple of questions we always sign off with. One of them is for Dr. Charlie Tiao, what makes a life worth living?
Well, with me, it sounds a bit cliche-ish, but the ability to give and not just take. It's very easy to take, but I find more gratification and more quality of life if I still have the ability to give somehow, give hope, give life, give charity, give love, give kindness. I mean, Joe, let's face it, the world's in turmoil. I mean, I know everyone says that. Every generation thinks it's the last, it's the end of the world. But, you know, I didn't think you wanted to interview me today because it's such a trivial subject and a topic compared to what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in the Ukraine. And I thought that maybe your listeners would go, who wants to hear about his conflicts, when there are conflicts that are killing children all around the world. And so, again, I think I would like everyone to think about what makes life worthwhile. And what makes life, because I deal with death every day, and I see people at the end of their life, and I promise you I can give you some insights into what it's like at the end of life. If you haven't contributed, Joe, you feel empty. I know so many rich people who get to the end of their life and they feel like their life has been nothing because they've made a lot of money, but they haven't made the world a better place, or they haven't made someone's life better. They've just made a lot of money. And if you want some sort of parting message, a parting message is, please, if you want to make your life worthwhile, where you can go to your deathbed and feel like you've had a great life, contribute, you know, be kind. Be kind to your fellow man, be kind to animals, be kind and give rather than take. And I promise you it'll make you on your deathbed feel fulfilled and happy to die, because I've seen so many people that, you know, that get to the end of their life and they have all these regrets because their life has been so self-centered and so selfish that it has no meaning.
Sure. Man, where can these guys connect with you, and do you have anything that you would love our audience to go and check out?
Yes, I do have a foundation, Joe. It's called the Charlie Teo Foundation, and it's solely to raise money for brain cancer research. I think it's a very worthwhile, you know, I'm telling you why it's a good foundation, but it's quite a unique foundation because I identified some problems with charities. Number one problem is that they often get so big that a lot of money goes into the running of the charity. And so their overheads are, in Australia at least, if you go to the Australian Charities and Nonprofit Commission website, it talks about the figures of charities, and most of the big charities have overheads greater than 55%. Some of them, like 95% of the money goes to the running of the charity and only 5% goes to the cause. And I pledged that the Charlie Teo Foundation would run lean and base a lot of its work on volunteerism. And I'm pleased to report that our overheads have never been more than 20%, often around 10% to 15%, but never over 20%. And that's with no spinning. That's with no sort of fudging the figures. It's all very transparent. We publish our P&Ls every quarter, and you can see exactly where the money goes. And we have 3 employees. We raise somewhere between 5 and 10 million Australian dollars a year, and it goes to where it's meant to go. And the next thing is that it also funds out-of-the-box thinkers. So if you look at the history of cancer research and cancer advances, a lot of advances have been made by, you know, disruptive thinkers, not the ones who are employed by the big universities and with a big name, but these really sort of very out-of-the-box left-field thinkers. And so I pledge that the Charlie Teo Foundation would search the world in the hope that we would find these out-of-the-box thinkers to, again, accelerate finding treatments for brain cancer.
Amazing. Well, man, everything discussed today will be linked below. What a pleasure chatting, getting to know you, to learning more about your story. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this. And, I hope that this conversation goes out there to doing some good. And once again, man, thank you so much for taking the time. And it was a real, real pleasure for me.
No, thank you, Joe. And thanks for doing your research. I mean, you obviously were very, very, very obsessive with your research. You got it all right. You didn't have to do a fact check. Everything you said was correct. I appreciate the fact that you put so much effort into the interview and you had very good questions.